This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Here today with composer Donica Dennehy, and so many of the composers I've had on this program, Cadenza is now in its 11th year. You're one of those composers, almost singularly, maybe with your compadre over at Princeton, Steve Mackey, who it's almost impossible to categorize and put labels on your music. That's what I find anyway. Yeah. And so that could be a bad thing, but maybe it's just an example of what a composer is here in the first quarter of the 21st century. So a little bit weird question, but esoteric question to start with. But the idea of labeling styles, composers, and music, where are you at with that? Because you've come up against it your whole career.
I never think of it at all. And people label me at different times. Yeah. And my wife gets upset at certain things. She goes, you're not that. It's much more subtle than that or complex than that. Whereas I don't care. Actually, I don't even pay attention to how I'm labeled. I think if you fit too easily within a label, it sort of means you're doing what's already done before. So that's why you can fit so nicely into that label. And the labels for anything you're doing now usually come about after the fact, you know, like.
Actually, it's kind of a healthy sign, isn't it, that composers, there's trouble labeling them, which is a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah. How would you label Stravinsky?
Well, it depends on what part of his life, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And now we have historical perspective, too, to see what he was doing.
Yeah.
But I mean, many composers on 40s and under and stuff, it's just, I guess that difficulty, is a good thing, actually.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I have this term post-minimalist applied to my music, and I think that that's way too reductive for what I actually am doing, because I do a lot with microtones, and there's this quite lyric, poetic kind of inclination in it, too. And I just think that that just doesn't capture very much of it. Yeah.
You use techniques or points of inspiration. I want to get to those in the interview. One is very old. One is based on nature, so I guess it's older than anything else.
Yeah.
and the other is using modern technology. But before we get to those, I want to back up and talk about growing up in Dublin and what the music scene was around you that stuck with you growing up, that shaped any part of you as you decided you could create and become a composer. What stuck with you? What was going on around you?
You know, it was kind of, I was just talking about this last night there in DC. It's kind of a weird thing for an Irishman to want to be, is a composer, because you don't really associate Ireland and composers. If I were Austrian, you'd go, okay, yeah, all right. Or even American, maybe, at this stage. But
poet would be the line you'd want to go, right?
You think of Ireland, you think of writers, mainly.
Right, writers
or
and poets,
of,
right?
Yeah, and it was a weird thing for me because I come from this kind of lower middle class background. And there I was at age 9 thinking I'd be a composer. And I even read about Beethoven having notebooks. And so I decided I'd have a notebook in case I was hit with any idea anywhere. So I went around. I mean, I didn't tell anyone about it because I knew people would tease you.
Yeah.
But I had a notebook just in case I had any ideas, and would kind of write down musical ideas as they came to me. And I would record these massive recorder sonatas, which I call them symphonies. So I started learning music quite late because I didn't really come from a musical family. My father was an insurance clerk, but he also wrote. He wrote plays. Yeah. He wrote radio plays. Evening, and had worked in the RTE, the radio station, as a sound engineer. His mother was actually a very good traditional fiddler, traditional Irish violin music, fiddle music. His two sisters were actually nuns, Catholic nuns. And my father was an atheist, I think for that reason, and was very anti-religion, which was an interesting upbringing to have in Ireland. But so they had this kind of thing where they sang in church and played the organ and things like that. And then on my mother's side, they weren't really particularly musical family, but they loved parties and these long sessions where they would have kind of concerts at their house through the night, really, at my grandmother's house.
Yeah.
And everyone would sing. And the tradition that they sang in was a kind of Shannos tradition, which I went back to in this piece. So there was a kind of traditional music element in my family, but not classical music, apart from the nuns. But so I became interested in it. But then I was really interested in rock music in my teenage years. I suppose I knew from about 9 that I wanted to be a composer. It sounds bizarre. When in my teen years, I thought maybe it might be more in rock, but then it moved back. And some people hear kind of rock elements in some of my music, but I actually think it's kind of accidental. I'm not doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
I often don't know what the hell is influencing my music. I just
see,
sort of
it goes
write
back
it.
To my first question.
Yeah.
It's hard to nail down.
But there is a kind of energy or ecstatic quality from that I really like also in traditional music as well. But I was super interested, even from an early age, like 10, 11, in the avant-garde, like Stockhausen.
Yeah.
I dragged my poor mother to see Stockhausen when he visited Dublin. And
she must have really loved you.
She fell asleep. She went along. It was a huge snow and we had to walk for some of it. And so she was quite tired. She was pregnant. And she fell asleep during it. But
you came to the States. You studied University of Illinois. But then you got to go back and you got to go to the continent, you know, where all that avant-garde music. And you were going to study, or you were going to a place where to hopefully study with somebody who was into spectral music. And I guess we have to take a moment here and just give our listeners, like, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
You can correct me on this definition. Spectral music, music based on tone color and overtone series rather than structures of melodic or something like that.
Yeah, the overtone series is really vital to it. I mean, yeah, so I had done my undergrad in Trinity in Dublin, just to give some perspective, and then went and did my graduate studies in the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. So that was my first time coming to America, a country now that has a lot of importance for me.
Right.
And I loved it. It was a great experience. And there was a guy there who was a visiting musicologist called Lev Kobliakov. And he gave a presentation on current trends in European music. which I basically had ignored because I had gone from Ireland to America. There was a piece that he played by Gerard Griset called Modulation that I just found astonishing. I just couldn't believe the sound of it. And there were a lot of friends of mine in Illinois who were writing microtonal music, because Illinois was in a way a hotbed for that because Ben Johnson had been there. But weirdly for me, it never made an impact on me because I heard it as this kind of horizontal melodic stuff and it just sounded like weird melodies or whatever. Although I since kind of love some of that music. And I heard this piece from Griset, it was like it was part of the sound. And of course it transpires that he was analysing sound. They analysed sound and looked at the overtone content in that. So if you play an A on a clarinet and an A on a piano, what distinguishes that? And it's actually the overtone series. And so they then made these translations between those analyses into their writing, into what pitches they would use and how they would orchestrate. And I found that fascinating. And I wrote to Griset and just said, I just thought this is amazing. And I gave him my music and would he, could I study with him? And he wrote back a beautiful little note to say that I had a really strong voice and that he would be very happy to take me as a student. So I traveled over to Paris.
There's one small problem.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but I sensed that he was disappointed. And then I looked at the letter he had written, Dear Miss Dunica Dennehy, that he was a bit disappointed that I was a man. And anyway, I went and I sat in a few of the classes and I found it a bit hierarchical, maybe. I made the decision I wouldn't go there. I decided to go to Holland. And in fact, in Holland, I wasn't even there very long before I got offered a job in Trinity in Dublin. Right. So that kind of curtailed my studies. And then I went back on a sabbatical year and used to meet informally with Louis Andreessen. So really, in a way, the hard studies I did were at Urbana-Champaign in Illinois. You know, but I did have that huge contact with Holland in particular.
Right. And listening to your music, I mean, if you talk about influences, Andreessen, I think, that seems like it might have been a really important part of your career that you actually got to study with Andreessen rather than...
Although I didn't formally study with him, so that's a sort of a misconception. And maybe that's possibly because of things I've said. I went to study at Sonology in The Hague, was in there. And then I met Louis at one of his classes at the Icebreaker. And we sort of became friendly instantly. Yeah. And I also invited him over when I set up this group, Crash Ensemble, came to Dublin. And so we became friends and he got me to come and talk to his class. And when I then went on sabbatical, I went and I had a number of kind of informal lessons with Louis. He had a huge impact on me, yes. Probably most direct of any composer because we interacted and also because I loved his music. You know, I loved what he was trying to say. And also I loved the fact that he was strongly influenced by minimal music, which had a huge impact on me too. But he didn't feel constrained by that to write like Louis Andreessen TM trademark. Mm-hmm. He has the bravery to search for new territory with each new piece. I get very nervous of artists that you feel have suddenly trademarked what they have found. And really, when you look in history, there's very few great composers that you think that just sort of gave up at a certain age once they thought they had found, you know, what sort of worked. And that is not the case with Louis. Mm. And I love that he has this searching philosophical nature to him. And I have that too. So that influences a lot of my works. I've just done a big piece on the Irish famine. And part of it are these interviews with Noam Chomsky and Paul Krugman talking about economics. And, you know, I think, why am I making my life difficult like this? I could just write music. But then there's also a part of me that goes, you know, I want to address some of these issues. These are important issues for us. So he definitely did. And there are certain things he said to me, small little things that I always think of when I write music. Just as important, though, as Louis was my friendship, I think, with the musicologist Bob Gilmore. Oh, very sadly died in January of last year from cancer. Bob was just an amazing musicologist of new music. Claude Vivier worked on Harry Parish, and he constantly introduced me to new music. Radulescu would send me CDs, scores. We would talk about music all the time. And in a weird way, there was a kind of education through Bob as well.
It's a great pipeline to have, you know?
Yeah.
My guest's Crash Ensemble in the first minutes of his piece called Glamour Sleeper. Music by my guest today, Dunica Dennehy. Thank you. You name dropped the group here, but in 97 in Ireland, you formed the Crash Ensemble. When you formed it in 97, what was the new music scene like in Ireland? What was going to be the goal of the ensemble as you formed it?
Yeah, so I came back basically, all right, from Holland, from America via Holland to Ireland. So I had got this job at Trinity, where I essentially disappeared for a week when they offered me the job because I wasn't so sure if I should take it because I was young and I was happy being in Holland after being in America. And I don't know, I wanted to sort of, you know, I had never any desires to have a job in academia, actually, weirdly enough, even though it was a professor at Illinois told me I should apply for it. But anyway, I decided to take it. And in the end, it turned out to be a kind of great decision because Ireland was in what was called the Celtic Tiger boom at that stage. Mm. Largely turned out to be kind of meaningless, but there was huge optimism. And it was a great place to return to. Like, you could feel it in the air, this kind of sense of anything being possible. But I don't want to criticize anyone that was there because there was a new music scene in Ireland, you know, and there were composers there who were inspirations to me when I was younger. For example, Gerald Barry. But Gerald Barry, he was inspiring as a composer for following his own path, but he wasn't really part of the scene in a way. He didn't have an ensemble. He mainly did work in Britain because they supported him. I mean, that's the reason. And then he more and more then started writing in Ireland and stuff like that, but there wasn't many groups doing new music, and what new music they were doing was more along, how would you say, respectable plink plonk, you know. As for that, didn't interest me. I wanted something that felt a bit more vital and vigorous, and I saw no outlet for my music, so I set up Crash Ensemble for that reason, in a way. And I wanted to present sort of music that was never aired in Ireland, music that was influenced by minimalism or post-minimalism, and music that had dealt with pulse, stuff that dealt with overtones, basically all my interests.
Right.
And also music that maybe played with multimedia or played with the idea that a concert didn't just have to be something that you suffered as a kind of penance, you know. And it was a huge success, Crash was, in the early days. We actually used to have lines going down the block to come in.
Very cool.
Yeah, for the first 3 years, I think all concerts were sold out.
Wow.
You could not get a ticket. It was like a... Now, they weren't playing in 2,000-seat venues. You were playing in like 300-seat places, but still. And that was like fiercely exciting for me. And of course, what was great about having Crash Ensemble was that it was like a laboratory for my own music I would write for them. And actually, it's only recently that I've stepped back from Crash, although I think that's correct because I think there's time for everything, you know, and there's part of me that can be quite tough about thinking these things. I think, oh, right, that's enough time on that. Otherwise, you're not going to do anything new, you know, you're not challenging yourself. And so I still write for them, but I feel that my time of just kind of developing every piece with them is over, but it was so important.
Were you able to find the musicians that wanted to play in an ensemble, they were there?
Well, it happened organically. In fact, I think the first concert of Crash that we had, which we invited Louis Andreessen over for, he was kind of the featured composer in the concert. He must have thought that was dismal altogether because it was pretty dismal. But now they're a really fine group.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're some of my greatest friends. They really have a passion for new music. It's like one of these things that we're like with Prism or So or Alarm Will Sound, you know, these people that really, they live for new music.
I mean, if you look at the new music ensemble scene in the US and you look at groups that have now been around 10, 15 years, you go back to Eighth Blackbird or something like that.
Yeah.
And that they have, but there's been a big spawning. Has Crash spawned other ensembles in Ireland?
Well, yeah, it's definitely influenced the younger generation.
Yeah.
I mean, and some of these were my students in Trinity. I was a fairly energetic teacher. One thing I said a lot to my students was to kind of, I hope I didn't bore them with this, was not simply just to accept conditions as they were. And if you were unhappy with them, it was your duty to try and change them, you know. So many of them did set up collectives and ensembles. And there is now a kind of a very lively scene of that in Ireland. Like, I'm really proud of two ex-students of mine, Ben Schlepper-Connolly and Garrett Shaldus, who set up this group called Air Goddess. Both have a kind of ensemble. They have a record label, and they put on concerts, and they kind of are a publisher as well.
Yeah.
In fact, they looked after my music until I just got recently published by Shermer. You know, I had those guys looking. And, you know, they're a real force, you know, for good.
Turn to your music, and I mentioned these techniques, these points of inspiration. The one that's nature rooted. I don't know if this is the one which you feel shows up most in your music, or is it starting point? And we talked about it. It's basing things on the harmonic series and overtones.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, has this been kind of a constant? This,
well, you know, weirdly, I had thought that I had only really properly got into this back around 2006, so about a decade ago, with a piece called Bob, which is like this real exploration of the... And then I was revising The Pale for Prism and so on. I went, oh my God, there's all this pitch bending in this. And so I think the desire to work beyond the 12 pitches was there very early on with me. And like... going back right to my early days as a composer, in a way that was kind of like you take this material and you vandalize it. But then it became more and more rooted in this kind of overtone series where resonance became really important for me. And part of that was also my real rediscovery of the Shandos tradition. And when I was doing this piece, Grogus Boss, for Earlo Leonard and Crash Ensemble, I analyzed a lot of this old Irish traditional singing Shandos and discovered that really if you fitted it within a kind of overtone lattice, as it were, it resonated in this greater way. So I then started writing these overtone accompaniments. And so it kind of happened organically in my style. I was just thinking about this the other day because you think of a composer like Arvo Pärt, where he definitely made a conscious decision towards it. So it didn't really happen, although you can hear it in works leading up to it. And then there are other composers where that kind of organically moves towards it. And I realized that I was organically moving towards more and more of this overtone stuff for probably 10 years.
So you kind of came into it, like you said, when you're in Illinois. I mean, someone like a Ben Johnston who's worked in quarter tones and microtones. Yeah. Stuff. Yeah. You sort of came into it trying to get those notes in between.
Yeah.
Am I wrong about that? You tried getting those notes in between sort of led you to the natural base of the overtones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sort of kind of, but also inside I was then often just using them gesturally or like something like an electronic distortion, because I did a lot of work with electronics.
Right.
And I love just the kind of visceral impact of pitch shifting something or like a Doppler effect. And I would just write out all these Doppler effects for instruments. And then that got me more and more interested in actually, there's something that here in this color, the sound. And there's no doubt about it that my first hearing, Grise, really did propel the decision to examine the overtone series in greater detail, because I don't love mathematics. And I was always veered away from it. You know, I never was interested in writing 12-tone music or anything like that. So I had to do a little bit of mathematics to work with the overtone series. So I did it as a means to an end, yeah.
We'll go to the other end of the spectrum, because the other one is the use of modern technology. I read... You said something once, you know, people say modern technology, whether it's electronics or if you want to bring it all the way up to computers and algorithms, all that stuff, sort of take all the human nature, humanity out of music.
Yeah.
And you said, and it's the opposite, actually. Yeah, just explain that, yeah.
Well, it certainly doesn't take all the humanity out of music, because actually the weird thing is that if you're using technology nowadays, you have a very fast feedback mechanism, I think. And if anything, it's encouraging you to be more instinctive because you're listening to how it is, rather than coming up with kind of mathematical plans in order to sort of plot your way through the piece. But I think you can have too much feedback too. So there is a kind of beauty in holding yourself back. It's like I love coffee. So it's like deciding I won't have another cup of coffee now for 2 hours. And you're holding yourself back. And then the beauty of it then is, so there is something to be said for just thinking about it rather than always having a feedback. But definitely technology, piano is a kind of technology. Harpsichords are kind of technology. Technology has forever influenced music. There is a danger, and I saw friends of mine in Illinois, particularly among algorithmic composers, where you can get so interested in writing the algorithms that you can actually forget about the music. I think that happens with people who are naturally better at writing algorithms than I am. I was never good enough at writing algorithms for it to take away from writing music. So there is a kind of natural thing. And I suspect that some people who really get sidelined by writing algorithms might be better at writing algorithms than writing music. You're drawn to what you want to do in the end, no matter what excuses you make. Yeah.
And you used it, well, the pieces I've heard, like the pieces for piano stuff, you've used it to add another, another layer.
Yeah, to do something that I couldn't do otherwise.
Right.
That's why I've done it. And like with Grogus Boss, which I mentioned, I wanted to do an analysis of these songs so as not just to do it based on what I knew of them, because I had grown up with these songs in a way and they were in my blood. I also wanted to step away from them. And what better way to step away from them than this kind of cold analysis as well? Because then that reveals other things. It challenges what you think about these things. And it would stain the staining, which is the piece you mentioned there, where I'm doing these. There's no way I could do build up this like haze of 100 overtones in that without using technology. And so that's producing something that will be impossible otherwise. Now, recently, I wrote a piece for this woman in New York called Nadia Sirota, which will be released early next year, called Tessellatum for Viola and 11 Vials. And I do that entirely acoustically, so I was super proud of that, where they put on extra frets, and it's just kind of stunning sound. I shouldn't say that myself. Self-praise is no praise, but, you know.
That's an interesting idea to refret the vial. Some music from my guest, Donica Dennehy's showing the spectral techniques, the closing minutes from his Stainless Steel for piano and soundtrack. The pianist is Lisa Moore. the last one, you've dropped the term here. Shonnos is is style the right word? It's a form of ancient Irish singing.
Yeah, and style is the right word Shonnos means old style,
right,
or old habit. And so Shan is old and Nos is style. It's basically the old style singing. It's the most revered traditional music in Ireland. Not as well known here in America, I would say, where I'd say the dance music is known much better. Or else some of the kind of rebel songs, which they're much more kind of modified, you know. But the Shonnos tradition, and it's throughout the country. There's such different variations, 30 miles apart, you know, you'll get a different, that's a different region of the, that's where they ornament this way. And but there's nothing really written down. I mean, there are books where they collect the songs, but really the way they perform are radically different from these notations. I became more and more interested in it. And then I happened to work with this, one of the finest exponents of the style, Iarlá Leonard. He's actually going to come as a visiting professor to Princeton next year. So it's a great opportunity for students. It was an amazing sort of thing to work with him. His voice is absolutely stunning. And the thing about this is that we don't know an awful lot about its history. In fact, they only really know about it coming back to about the 17th century. So we don't even know how ancient it is because there's no real notation. I mean, one suspects it goes back much, much further.
Sounds like it would.
Yeah. There are kind of connections. I mean, some have argued for connections with North African music too, because there was trade routes between North Africa and Ireland. Because sometimes, particularly when you hear it removed from certain contexts, like in my piece, it can almost have a kind of Arabic quality in some places because of the way it deals with the pitch and how strange it is with pitches. So one thing that I loved, and I worked with Iarlá, was working with him in this unaccompanied fashion, because I didn't want to have it sort of nicely tailored. You do get versions of Shonnos music which are kind of completely equal tempered for kind of a mass market, but that's not really the style.
A couple characteristics of it are the ornamentation.
Yeah.
Are those improvised when you write this, like when you wrote Grog's Boss?
Yeah.
Is that notated? Does he...
It's half notated in Grog's Boss.
Because when you get out of this oral tradition, it gets tough to...
I mean, other singers have done this piece.
Right.
It's not just Iarlá. There's a guy here in New York called Finnegan Shanahan. That's his real name. Because in Ireland, they always think that sounds
that's
like
a made-up
American
Irish name.
No, but it is. And he's a great musician. And he learned this style of singing to do it. So he's done it with his group, Contemporaneous. And I brought him to Texas, the University of Austin at Texas. We're putting on a concert of my music and he did it there. So there are others that can do it, which actually was really a happy find for me, because I do worry about that if you write so specifically for one. But I've just written this new piece, The Hunger on the Famine, and Iarlá's involved there too. And in this piece, I actually do write out more and more of the ornamentations so that they're there in the score. If someone else should want to do it. It's very hard for them to do it, though, in the style, unless you really listen to recordings of it. And it's a matter of so many other things, like getting the way you deviate the pitch, the color, where in the vocal cords you produce certain sounds, where it's head, etc. So there's a lot like that that even varies, actually, from region to region, but it's hard to pin it down.
I mean, there's a lot of these vocal traditions, indigenous vocal traditions, all over the world that you have this, whether they're using pitches that fall definitely in between our keys on the piano, whether it's a slide. I mean, you think of Bulgaria, you think of North Africa. Is there something about Shonnos that makes it particularly indigenous to Ireland?
Oh, yeah. Well, it only happens in Ireland, that type of singing. Yeah, oh yeah, but
I mean, how do you differentiate it if you're listening? Yeah, I mean, is it caught up with the language?
It's definitely caught up with the language. It's also got to do with the kind of modes that it operates in. Mm. It's got to do with the way it cadences. It's got to do also with the way that basically in Shonnos, you rarely finish phrases in the right place. So you rarely finish the musical thought at the same thought. You always cut the verbal thought in Shonnos. Mm. So you divide in the middle of the sentence and then it starts anew. It's weird like that. And actually, I've taken that and used that in English too. But it's also got to do with the fact that largely it's a kind of major modality. So, you know, the Eastern Europeans, when they're sad, you know about it. And with the Irish, when you're sad, you don't always know about it, because we are a much more obscure sort of nation. Because Ireland is a very friendly country on the surface and almost joyful. But there's all these hidden things. Yeah. And it's in the music too, for sure. That there is this kind of major modality that comes out of Irish music when it's singing about some terrible things. And part of how you convey the kind of terribleness of it is with just occasional colorings of the ornaments. Yeah.
It's something that'd be tough for an ear not accustomed to it to pick up as where its roots are, correct? I would think.
Would you say so? Yeah, probably. People wouldn't know that that was Irish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that you're using the style and technique to give it more exposure. Yeah. As long as we're talking about vocal music, let's slide into your theater pieces. I don't know what you want to call them, operas. Or, I mean, you just had a performance the night before we're recording this, Washing with the Hunger.
Yeah.
And you got the Lost Hotel pieces like this.
Yeah.
Odd question, but I mean, of what a composer can write these days and the forces to get them and make sure they're successful. And why do these types of pieces? What's in you that says, I need to do something that has a narrative of some way, vocal, voice, instrument? I mean, why do these pieces?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because they're harder to put on.
But definitely, And these days, they're all these multimedia because,
Yeah, Last Hotel isn't actually. It's pure theater in a way. I did with this Irish writer, Enda Walsh. I mean, there is a kind of wonky slideshow in it, but you'd hardly call it multimedia.
Before you go on, do you want to categorize these as operas or not?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, they're calling both The Hunger and Last Hotel operas. I would consider Last Hotel an opera in a kind of a standard way because it has a narrative and it's very much a theatrical thing that unravels in time. The Hunger, they call it an opera. I mean, Alarmo Sound has called it that and various press people, it's going to come up in all these other performances soon. I don't know about calling it an opera, and I deliberately don't call it an opera myself. It's a kind of docu-opera or a kind of opera documentary. That's what I would kind of call it. It's not enough just to say it's a piece because it has narratives in it and it's going to be staged. So where do you say, oh, well, then that's music theater? That was a phrase that they used a lot in the 60s, music theater.
Yeah.
But it kind of implies a 60s sort of piece.
For Robert Ashley things and stuff.
Oh, well, I love Robert Ashley, actually. Yeah.
But those kind of things are hard to categorize.
Well, he called them operas.
He did, but when I saw them, you wouldn't walk away from it saying, that was an interesting opera.
I think this is something that people, see, that sort of stuff, I literally don't care about, like what you're going to call something.
Sure,
because I think you shouldn't really write something worrying about how will you actually categorize it in the end. Because it does make a difference, I think, in terms of grand rights and stuff like that. I just found that out. But yeah, I don't even think of those things. So The Last Hotel is definitely a kind of opera. And I'm going to write another one with Enda, which is another kind of opera. And The Hunger is a sort of music theater piece, or a kind of opera documentary, because it's all source texts as well. So that's what's kind of different about it. But it will be staged. It'll be staged at BAM in end of September, start of October. And it's written with a staging in mind. So what we presented yesterday at the Kennedy Center was a kind of concert version of a piece to be staged.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't think you properly appreciate it until you see this on stage, as it's supposed to be, because that's the way I've written it. So it's a staged piece. Now, you might say, why do I bother with this? Well, one is that I've been lucky. I've been lucky that people want to do staging with me. And in that regard, it's probably the only thing where I can think that you're lucky to come from Ireland, because it's harder in Ireland. Our funding for the arts is even lower than America. And Americans, I think, always think, oh, Europe is much more enlightened when it comes to the arts. But you're thinking of Germany and the Netherlands and Finland and Sweden. But there are other countries in Europe, and Ireland is one of those. And Ireland only spends its 0.6% of its budget on the arts, or 0.06 maybe it is. It's probably 0.06. Yeah, 0.06. And it's tiny. Actually, someone told me the other day it's even less than what the American, not just the normal philanthropy, but the American government, like NEA and all that, spend on the arts. So, that can be hard there. But the one thing is that there is this incredible tradition of theatre, and that's the one area that's kind of funded. And I have been lucky that, it sort of things spiraled. I asked Enda, would he do this opera? He agreed. And we managed to get funding then because of that as well. We could put it on, and we were very lucky on who wanted to present it in Europe in particular.
Yeah.
And they all came with money. And so that helped. And we already are raising money for the next project. And so that's exciting. I am lucky, although I put in the work, to have that position. Doing The Hunger here proved a much harder thing, because I did it with Lama Sound and, they're scrambling for grants and that was harder, and somehow it's happened organically, and now we've the backing of BAM, and that's made us be able to actually go towards doing a stage version. But that took 4 years really to properly be able to see, and having to do it in bits, and then my having to, you know.
Last Irish part, because you just brought it up, then we'll come back to the States. But, you know, Ireland, you went to sort of at the periphery of Europe. You just said they don't spend much on the arts. You had to sort of finagle to go to the theater route.
Yeah.
But you also said that because of that, I think it was a quote of yours, it sort of gave you the freedom. I mean, you weren't tied into certain dogmas and processes of schools because you were over. I mean, is it a sort of both sides of the sword type of thing?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a double-edged sword. I do think you're not fighting tradition in the same way as if you were a German or an Austrian. Now, that's actually weird, though, for present-day German and Austrian artists, because the kind of modus operandi, in a way, there is that you have some sort of ironic relationship to the past. Scratch beneath, you know, Lachenmann or whatever, and there's all this kind of issue where you quote, but you're using these kind of very extreme techniques and these. And there's a kind of strong emphasis put in writing a kind of Neue Musik, you know. And I know that because I traveled a lot there and actually spent time. And that has had a big influence on my thinking in a way. But I also feel really happy that in a way I feel I have the liberty to do whatever I want. And maybe I've just granted myself that liberty too. But there is something about being on the periphery, where there's a lot of bad things about it, but there is a kind of freedom that comes with it, and the freedom of being under the radar as well. Yeah. You know, I found that really liberating for a while. Like, and maybe that was my rationale for remaining in Dublin too. That's how I kept myself happy. Oh, well, you know, we have the capacity to make it up whatever way we want. There was, among the older guard of composers in Dublin, a very strongly European modernist bent. Many of them had gone and studied.
That was their comfort zone.
Yeah. So I definitely ruffled feathers with my American influences and like being interested in Dutch music. And bizarrely, when you look back on it, but that was kind of controversial at the time, and because of Crash and all that. But I saw that as being weird for Ireland, with a radically different history, being essentially the only colonized country in Western Europe, to feel that it was somehow like a normal other European country. Its art should behave in that way, when its literature didn't behave in that way. Its literature had a very askew connection, that was part of its power. And I really felt that that was what we should be doing, you know. I really felt that we should embrace the periphery, embrace the kind of space between also being influenced between Europe and America. And like, we have such a strong artistic connection with America, and also with the, you know, our population. Yeah. So many people, like in my own family, like my uncle had emigrated to America when he was 17, and, you know, the whole famine and where we were geographically, first country off the Atlantic Ocean. So we were always in our space, in our cultural space, influenced by both trends.
Talk about a different slant. You're now here at Princeton. Yeah. And these students at Princeton, whether they're in studying composition or just musicians, are not in a quote-unquote typical conservatory music school.
No.
That's not what Princeton is. And just talk a little bit about these students, which are a very different breed type of thing. They can be phenomenal musicians, and yet they might be looking at a life track which doesn't include any kind of professional musicianship.
Well, there are two types of students at Princeton. There's the undergrads and there's the grads. I mean, I know that sounds kind of like, oh yeah, whatever. But there is, they're radically different, because the grads are definitely people who are wanting to make a life in music. They're doing graduate studies in music. And, you know, we have phenomenally gifted composers applying to the grad program in Princeton. And so it's a luxury. So I love teaching there for that reason. You know, we have quite amazing students who are quite inspiring in their own right. Of course, they learn just as much off each other. And also the program in Princeton, thanks, you know, to people like Steve Mackey and Paul Lansky, is deliberately non-prescriptive. It doesn't believe that this is the program to make you a great composer. It's trying to encourage things that you have in you already. And of course, you have a great starting thing, because, you know, more than 150 people or whatever apply, and they're really brilliant, you know. So these are the ones who are even sort of brave enough to apply in a weird way. I hate to say that, but that's, that's the way it is. And it's kind of a lottery, to be honest, to get in, because so many of those people could get in. So you have these amazing musical personalities as the grad students. And so they are definitely on a track. Half of them already have quite good careers, you know. With the undergrads, it's a completely different story, because it's a liberal arts college. I hope I have this right. You know, I'm not fully, you know, I didn't grow up in America, so I don't know the system inside out, but I know enough of it now. And, you know, many of them are majoring in engineering or computer science. I'm just picking some of the subjects where you often get some quite brilliant musicians, mathematics,
mm-hmm.
yeah, across the arts or whatever. And music is just one of the subjects there. But you do get people who major in music. What they bring to it is, because they are often really super intellectual as well, like they're really kind of brilliant, these undergrads at Princeton, is that they bring a kind of breath to it, you know. But, I mean, that was even a kind of a surprise for me coming from Trinity in Dublin. You're essentially, as an undergrad in music, you're declaring it in your first year. So you're more focused as a musician, already, whereas here you declare it in your third year and everything. But what it does bring is a kind of recognition of music's place among other things. So you do get this very interesting kind of thoughtfulness among those who decide. But it is different from a kind of conservatory thing, you know, where all your friends can perform your music.
And there's sort of a track that you're
on. Yeah, a track. Yeah, I mean, I've debated that in my head because there's part of me that loves that, you know, the track, you know, because there's a lot of depth you can go into very fast, whereas here you go into the depth slightly later. But some of these guys are so brilliant that it happens pretty fast then, you know.
Before we close, just you mentioned the piece from Ms. Sirota and
yeah,
just had her dad on as a Cadenza guest a couple
of years
ago.
Yeah, Bob Sirota.
Yeah, anything else you're working on that you...
Unless you're superstitious
about it, some
composers are. No. Yeah. Oh, well, I can be superstitious about some things, but not about what I'm working on, actually. I just finished a quartet for the Doric Quartet. They're going to premiere in London next month at the Wigmore Hall, and then they're going to bring that to Carnegie Hall because they were the co-commissioner in the spring. And then I'm going to write another opera with Enda Walsh, which is going to be crazy. And we'll see what that comes up. I think it's going to go on sometime next fall, not the fall coming, but the next year. And then I'll be doing a standalone piece for Soul Percussion, which I'm very much looking forward to.
The theatre pieces are going to keep popping up.
They are. I like that world. Oh my God, the amount of work is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal. And it's much more divisive when you do a theatre work than when you do a music work in some sort of way. Possibly also because writers can write about it in some way, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, many critics don't even really know much about music, so they don't know what to write about, whereas they can actually... But I don't care about that. And there is a kind of... I don't know, there's something that draws me. I love writing for voices. And I never knew that that was the case, you know, because I was not really a great singer. But I do sing when I compose and I record myself and everything. But I don't want the larger public to hear that. Although I had a singer the other day saying actually I was quite a good singer for a composer.
Well, to draw people like Don Upshaw.
Yeah.
That's no slouch.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to anything that comes off your pen or your computer or whatever it comes off these days. I close on my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, something you never had a chance to, but you could. What's the first name that pops in your head?
Janáček.
Janáček.
Yeah.
That's a different
name. Yeah. I would love to talk to Janáček about his ideas about the speech melodies.
The speech thing, yeah, I can see that.
And also, I really want to know what suddenly made him blossom later. I mean, of course, the standard thing is the love. And it could be love, but love might have been bound to happen anyway. I don't know. I would like to talk to Janáček.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
First person in 11 years to pick Janáček.
Yeah.
Second question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy, a lot of stuff coming up. When you have to take yourself away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, something that takes you away from music, what do you do?
Oh, I'm really embarrassed to admit this at the moment, but I follow this election like nobody's business.
Aye.
And I can't take my eyes off that phenomenon that is the Donald and how it's happening. And I have to admit, I'm probably one of these people who's feeding the media frenzy because I lap it up, you know. I read all the articles on it and strangely find it relaxing, but that should not be the case. I should be sort of semi-terrified.
Making Americans tense as all.
But, you know, that's like just following the news. That I've always been supremely interested in. Actually, I've always followed American elections, bizarrely. So that's something I really enjoy.
Relax by being a political junkie.
Yes.
Tanaka Dennehy, thanks for taking some time.
All right, thank you.
Composer Tanaka Dennehy. You can find out more about him at his website, Tanaka Dennehy, D-O-N-N-A-C-H-A-D-E-N-N-E-H-Y, www.pale.com. His work called Pale will be part of our broadcast tomorrow evening at 8, a concert presented by two of the most dynamic chamber groups around, the Philly-based saxophone quartet Prism and their guests, So Percussion. It is a premiere of this version of my guest's work, and coming up at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on the 30th of September and October 1st at 8 p.m. will be his docu-opera, The Hunger, featuring Erla O'Leonard, Kate Manley, and the ensemble Alarm Will Sound. More info about those performances can be found at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's website, BAM.org. And I'll leave you with the final minutes from the work which employs not only the singer, Erla O'Leonard, but the ancient Irish singing Sean Nose technique. Our soloist is accompanied by the Crash Ensemble. We'll hear the final minutes of Gro Agus Bas, Love and Death. Music by my guest today, Donica Dennehy. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and at wwfm.org.
Oh!